Now tonight is our subject. Our subject is the beasts appear. Will you turn with me, please, now to chapter 13 of the book of the Revelation? And I'm going to ask you to look back into chapter 12, remembering that chapter 12, 13, and 14 are a parenthetic portion, in fact the third parenthesis in this book. A parenthesis is a stay in the onward march of events in order to explain some particular point. And the point at issue in this parenthesis is the powers that are operating upon earth. Chapter 12 has set before us the dragon, the woman, and the man-child. The dragon, of course, symbolizes Satan. The woman symbolizes Israel, the one through whom the Messiah, the nation through whom the Messiah came, and the man-child, of course, is Christ. Now I'm going to ask you for the connection, please, to look at the last verse of chapter 12. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed. That's the remaining part of the nation of Israel that has not already been stamped out. Make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now I would make a little point here. The Revised Version makes no distinction in the chapter division, because the original doesn't make any distinction, and it makes one little change that I think is significant, and I read it as in the Revised Version. Keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, and he stood upon the sand of the sea. Full stop. That makes the he, the dragon. Now continue chapter 13. And saw, and its eye saw, that's John, a beast rise out up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth was as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat, that's his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, just underline in your mind the as it were, wounded to death. That's the same word exactly that's used of the lamb slain in chapter 5. As it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him? And I want you to notice the four things that are given to the beast. There was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemy, and power was given, that's number two, unto him to continue 42 months. Remember, that's exactly 3.5 years. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given, this is number three, it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. And power was given, number four, given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations, and all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. The word preposition from ought to be translated since. Look, please, at verse number 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, or in his presence, and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was he. And he doeth great wonders. The word is sign. He doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those signs, is the word, which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause them that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and the number is 666. One or two other verses of explanation, please, in chapter 17. This is the chapter we'll deal with tomorrow night, but I want one particular explanation here. Verse number 9. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. I submit, and I will be suggesting tomorrow night, nothing to do with Rome. It's the wrong word. Number one, and where you get seated, sitting in this chapter, and you have it, the woman sitting on many waters, you have her sitting on the beast, and here you have her sitting on seven mountains. It's nothing whatever to do with location. It has to do with support. That which bears her up. That's the idea. And so the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Leave out the italicized there, and you have the explanation. Seven heads, seven mountains, seven kings. And here is the explanation. Five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. When he cometh, he must continue a short space, and the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. I just point out one further thing. This must speak not of an empire, but of a man. You cannot send an empire to perdition. It's a man that is banished to perdition. So keep those little footnotes of explanation, please, in mind. We trust the Lord will bless the reading of His Word. As we are looking into the future events that will follow on earth after the rapture of the church, the Lord, having taken His church home, events move onward and into the 7-year tribulation period. Now, what is before us tonight is a study of two mighty men, two charismatic men. Men more powerful than any men have ever been. And these two men become the focus of the tribulation period. Their coming, the control of event, the climax to which the tribulation moves are centered upon these two tremendous personality, and we have them before us under the symbolism of beasts. And the word is not the same as we had in chapter 4, the living one. This is the word for wild beast, and it indicates that in the view of heaven, these two men, so mighty, so marvelous before the eyes of men, have a beastly character that's unrestrained by divine action. Now, just for a moment or two, let me just bring the picture up to date. We started this particular avenue of study in chapter 4 and 5, where we focused upon a throne. And in the hand of a throne sitter, a scroll, a 7-sealed scroll. Then the focus fell upon the Lamb. And the climactic moment was when the Lamb took the scroll out of the hand of the throne sitter. That action and the opening of the seal is heaven's view of the commencement of this 7-year tribulation period. Now, the 7 seals opened. We looked briefly at the first 6 last night. But I would point this out. When, before the 7th seal is opened, there's a parenthesis in chapter 8. That parenthesis stops the action that you might focus upon points that need to be explained. And the point in chapter 7 is this, that there are persons who go into the tribulation, and there are people that come out of the tribulation. The persons who go in are seen. 144,000 exactly, not one more, not one less. 12,000 from each tribe in Israel. Every one of them Jews, but miraculously saved. Possibly on the pattern of Saul of Tarsus. Stopped supernaturally and saved and then sealed. And the picture is the winds being held in abeyance, the tribulation cannot start until these are sealed. That's the first company they go in. It's not stated but implied they are going to preach the gospel. The second company in chapter 7 are an innumerable company. They can't be numbered. And they're coming out of the tribulation. This is focusing now on the end. And the implication is clear. They are the result of the preaching of the first company. They are saved. I just made two remarks. They're not martyred, and they're not in heaven. They are on earth, and I submit, for those who know their Bible, they are the sheep of Matthew 25 that go into the tribulation, into the millennium on earth. That's the first parenthesis. The seventh seal is open. There's a silence in heaven for half an hour. Is that the length of time that the incense takes to be offered on that altar of incense? Or is it the period for the reading of the scroll, the title deed of earth? I submit that to you to think about. The book is not open until the seventh seal is broken. A pause, because now you're moving to the second phase of judgment, not the seal, but you're moving to the trumpets. Now the war trumpets are to be blown. Heaven is at war with earth, and you can see the result as trumpet after trumpet after trumpet is blown, and you get a blasted earth. You get a bloodied sea. You get a blackened sky. You get these evidences of divine action taking place, chapter 8, and into chapter 9, where you get the sixth trumpet. But before the seventh trumpet is blown, there's another pause. Further explanation. Not persons this time, but places. What places are going to be affected? And there's two mentioned, one in chapter 10 and one in the first part of chapter 11. What's the first place? All creation. Don't confine these things, please, to the prophetic earth. Expression you don't find in your Bible. Don't confine them to Europe. They touch all creation, and the mighty angel, who's not Christ, please. One word disproves any suggestion that it is Christ. Another, as a class. Christ doesn't belong to any class. So that it's not Christ. But it's heaven's emissary, claiming creation of fruit on the sea and of fruit on the land. That's what's going to be affected. But then the focus comes in the second place, Jerusalem. That city that's been at the center of prophecy for millennia. It's back again, and there's a temple built. A literal temple built in Jerusalem. It can be measured. That's chapter 11. But then you come to the seventh trumpet. And the seventh trumpet is blown. But before you get the consequence of that, which will actually be the outpouring of the seven bowls, the last judgment, that take you to the very final day of the tribulation period. There's another pause, another parenthesis. That's where we are tonight. People, parenthesis one. Places, parenthesis two. Parenthesis 3, power. What power
in his work on earth. And chapter 12 will tell you, the dragon, he's been at work historically. He has been opposing the people of God in ages past, Israel. It's the idealized picture of Israel as the woman expecting. She brings forth a child. It's a symbolic picture. That child, the man child, strange word, but points to Christ. That child, the dragon, stands ready to devour. But that child is caught up to heaven. It's Christ seen as the one who's been taken back to glory. Yes, Satan thought he had Christ in his power when he had him on the cross, when he had him in the tomb. But God smashed the bar and his son came forth. He's taken him back to glory. And Satan's in a rage. And he turns on the woman. As again, there's a time gap. The church age is left out. And you're brought to the midpoint of the tribulation. When there's war in heaven, Satan is banished. Down he comes. Knowing his time is short. He's only 3.5 years. And he turns with absolute ferocity on the woman, on Israel, genocide on an unparalleled scale. You think the Holocaust was bad? It'll be nothing to this. But how does Satan achieve it? Here's the answer. He stands on the seashore. John watches. The dragon. Symbol of Satan. And he supervises. The only word I can use. He supervises the advent, the arrival, the appearance of his puppets. His mighty puppets. Men that will be as tools in his hand. And he watches. And the first comes from the sea. What a mighty prince he is. And the second turned as John would be turned from watching westward, turned eastward. He sees another beast come from the land. And he sees Satan's mighty prophet, prince and prophet. And these are the two that he's going to use against Israel. But against a wider company, against all that would speak for God, that would adhere to Christ. And we're going to focus very specially upon the end part of the tribulation. But just a moment. Let's look at the first beast. The beast from the sea. And that is described for us in the first 10 verses of this chapter. Let me speak, please, of his advent. John sees him come out of the sea. Now, if we keep our symbolism in order, trying to interpret each symbol consistently, the sea will speak of the nation, just as the land will speak of the nation. The sea will speak of a certain turbulence, but there's no storm here as there is in Daniel. But the land will speak of ordered government. So what are you seeing? You're seeing the advent of one from the nation. And this one is given certain description, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And as soon as you read that, Well, that will click. That's the description of the dragon. What's the dragon on the seashore? He has 7 heads and 10 horns. And here this beast that appeared has 7 heads and 10 horns. In other words, it's almost a reproduction of Satan himself. There's a slight difference in this. That in chapter 12, the horns on the heads of the dragon are crowned. Here it's the horns are crowned. There's a point in that. This beast has 7 heads and 10 horns. But then John looks a little bit closer. What's he look like? He looks like a leopard. And then he says, look at his feet. His feet were as the feet of a bear. His mouth as the mouth of a lion. And you say that echoes in my mind. Those are the very animals, the leopard, the bear, and the lion that Daniel saw. The 3 beasts that preceded the 4th beast. And here is another beast. There's a parallel, therefore. These things don't stand independently. You can see that this is an empire. Did you get that word? You'll be saying I'm contradicting myself, but I'll explain in a moment. You see, there are 4 empires to appear before the final empire. 4 empires from Nebuchadnezzar's day. Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. 1, 2, 3, and then an unnamed one. Just 4. You would say, but historically the 4th was Rome. That's right. But wait now. There's only 4. And you have no room for any more. So, the 4th one must be Rome, in a sense, but different from Rome. And if you skip out the church period, the intervening time between the Pentecost and the rapture, what you're seeing is the reappearance of an empire that has features of Rome, but is far greater. Far more massive, far more powerful than Rome could ever be. This is the 4th empire. And this is the empire that is in existence when the stone is cut out of the mountains, Christ, without hand, and smashes the image. And it brings in the millennial kingdom. So what you're seeing here is under the appearance of the beast first, an empire. A mighty empire. With 7 heads and 10 horns, and the horns are crowned. That is, you're seeing it at a point where this 10 horns have a royal rule, a kingly rule. When you come to chapter 17, there's no crowns on the horn. Why is that? They have given their crowns to the beast. Now that's important. So we're seeing the advent of this empire rising and dominating and controlling. And it has links with the empires of the past. Here is this empire. But now, can I change it and say, it's not only an empire, it's an empire reflected in a man, in one man. And this is parallel with even what was seen in Rome. Rome was reflected and reproduced in a Caesar. Caesar, in one sense, was the empire and stood for the empire.
And the same idea is here. The same imagery used of the beast is imagery that identifies an empire, but it identifies an emperor. And I'll show you why just in a moment or two. And here is, first, the advent of the empire, but the empire will be seen in a man. And very likely, he'll move through the nation to take control of the greatest empire the world has ever seen. Now I might as well disclose my own conviction. I do not think that the 10-part kingdom is confined to Europe. Let me shock some. Did you know that economists today have divided the world into 10 economic zones and are in process of establishing not the group of 7, but the group of 10 that will bring together forces never before put under one control? I'm not saying that this will be the answer. I'm saying that it's significant. Out of something like that could arise an empire that will produce a leader, an emperor, who will have unprecedented and unparalleled power and will be the dominant man. Very likely he himself, putting other scriptures together, will come from the West. But we've looked at his advent. Let's focus just a moment on his appearance. We've discussed the description. Let's just turn for a moment, if you forgive me, to the 7 heads. And you say, now, what is the idea in the 7 heads? Well, chapter 17 tells us, it gives us the explanation that those 7 heads are, in fact, but the 7 mountains are 7 kings. For the only time, as far as I know, in the Revelation, you get a double symbol. But you're told that it's a double symbol. 7 heads speak of 7 mountains, and mountains in your Old Testament speak of kings. So you're seeing one who has the heritage of a past that's centered on 7 kings. And remembering that these are identified with satanic animosity and the dragon to Israel, you pause and you say, how many kings, how many kingdoms have been opposed to Israel? And I hope you're able to count simply down history. What do you find? There is, the first one was Egypt. The second one was Assyria. The third one was Babylon. The fourth one was Media Persia. The fifth one was Greece. Every one of them acted to stamp out the nation. Now the explanation to John of the heads is this. 5 are fallen. Those 5 that I have mentioned have passed, gone. But John is told, 1 is, and in John's day it was Rome. So what are you seeing? You're seeing the Roman power in the 6th. Stamping out Israel, that genocide that was embarked upon by the Caesars to wipe Israel off the map. 5 are fallen, 1 is, that's Rome, and the 7
One has not yet come.
In that statement, you're jumping the century to this point where this emperor comes from the sea. He's arrived. We're waiting him. The church is not waiting him. We're waiting the Savior. But earth is waiting him. And Henry Spack, the Belgian premier, at the first meeting of the United Nations, he spoke in words like this. What we want is a man of sufficient stature to hold the allegiance of all people and to lift us out of the economic morass into which we are sinking. Send us such a man, and be he God or devil, we will receive him. Satan will see to it. The man has arrived. His advent, his appearance, I'll speak tomorrow night and show you, or maybe later tonight. He's the seventh, but he's the eighth. Say, how could he be the seventh and the eighth, and of the seventh? There's an assassination, or an assassination attempt in between. It speaks of resurrection. It's a pseudo-resurrection. It's a sham resurrection. We'll see it, how it comes in, in just a moment. But we've spoken of his coming, and earth will see the mightiest man come from the west, I judge. And his appearance, and the links that he has with the past, and now his authority. He has 10 kings under him. But that's not enough. The dragon, Satan, gave him his power. There's one behind him. That word, dynamis, is the word that speaks of all the military might that will be needed to ensure his place, his power, his throne. That's the next word. That's probably his political power. And that which goes with it, maybe by popular demand, militarily, politically, great authority, very possibly commercially, as he dominates earth. He has reached the levers of power, and Satan has slipped them into his hand. That's my man. That's the authority that he will weave right across earth. Well, something happened. Look at the next verse. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, it's only an appearance, but as it were, wounded to death. The same word as you have in the law. He's assassinated. I don't think, brethren, with all due respect, that this speaks of the Roman Empire. The decline of the Roman Empire was over a long period of time, without specifying. It never had any impact. Empires have risen and fallen. And they've risen again. And men have noted it, written about it in the columns of the media. But it hasn't made any impact. But you think what this impact this will make. You think what happened in the case of Jack Kennedy. You think of what happened in the case of the Israeli Prime Minister, or Sadat of Egypt, or Rabin of Israel. In full view of the world, an assassination attempt. And maybe just at the climax of the tribulation, the 3.5 year point, at a great ceremony, I'm only suggesting that one steps out of the crowd with a gun or a knife
or in some other way. And suddenly, he's cut down. He's wounded to death. And the world is in uproar, is in turmoil. He's gone.
Wounded to death. But, my, that night in Dallas, or the next morning, after what had been seen on the TV screen, there would have been worldwide shock if J.F. Kennedy had appeared on TV and said, I'm fine. Something like that will happen. His deadly wound was healed. It won't be God that healed him. His deadly wound was healed. And you can see what happened. All the world wondered. They're thunderstruck. That wording in English doesn't give you the impact. The whole world is thunderstruck. Because he's come back. We saw him killed. Now he arises. As it were, please. Not a true resurrection. But it's a sham. It's a sham of the resurrection of Christ. And the world is stunned. And can you wonder that the world wanders after the beast? And they worship the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast, say. Who is like unto the beast? Never been a man like this. We give him the first place. We give him the power. He deserves it. Now, other events. At that point, at the halfway point, because the period in a moment or two we'll see is 42 months that he's given. So this must happen at the very midpoint of the week of the tribulation. But other things have come together. You can see that maybe in the power of his resurrection, pseudo-resurrection, he turns on the two witnesses. Chapter 10. Those two men that have plagued the world and the earth dwellers, those who have made their home on earth, for 3.5 years, the first half of the tribulation, they have tormented, tortured, is the word, the people on earth, because they have reminded them that God was still there. And like Elijah, the heavens were closed, a drought for 3.5 years. Like Moses, water turned into blood. And suddenly, the beast, the emperor, turns on these two men in Jerusalem and puts them to death. He's challenged heaven successfully. What could heaven do against such a mighty man? He's put the two witnesses to death. And they lie on the streets of Jerusalem for 3.5 days. You say, why 3.5 days? I submit it's quite simple. The emperor, by direct order, says, don't bury them. Let the TV cameras of earth focus on those bodies in the streets of Jerusalem. Two men. For 3 days, that's essential. There's going to be no stories about resurrection about these men, is there? As there was about Christ. So they keep them in public view. And they send presents one to another. They declare a world holiday. God has been given a death blow. The beast is in control. And you can see how the world will react. But what you, just to finish that story, you remember that after 3.5 days, the witnesses and the world is watching. They stand on their feet. You're summoned to heaven. Jerusalem shakes. 7,000 died. The way it's put, almost it would seem the very people that have put their names to the program to wipe out the people of God. They're dealt a blow from heaven. That happens at this point. Then the beast decides he'd have to deal with the harlot, which we study tomorrow night. That's apostate Christianity. The Christianity that's left after all the saved people are gone. And there'll be plenty of it. And it'll be headed up in Rome. Roman Catholicism will be the shelter under which all that apostate religion will hide. And you can see then how that woman is supported by the beast. That's why she sits on the beast for the first 3.5 years. He's supporting her. It's in his policy. And he uses her for 3.5 years. And then decides, I don't need her anymore. And at that point, he and the 10 kings turn on the Roman Catholic Church and it's wiped out in a night. Do you believe it? Read chapter 17. See what happens to Rome. That's the story. It'd be wider than Rome. But it's centered in Rome. And on that evil system that has persecuted sin down the centuries. That has been the center of propaganda that has doomed so and is holding them even tonight in jail. That system will be destroyed by the beast and the 10 kings at the midpoint of his reign. There's likely a military invasion, Ezekiel 38 and 39. That's judged, dealt with. And the word goes round the earth, who is like unto the beast, who's able to make war with him. And he enters the last stage of his blasphemy, when an image is made of him, and it's set up in Jerusalem, in the temple. We'll come to that in just a moment. But that's the last stage of world religion going back to Babylon in all its clarity, not under certain shah like Rome, but going back to Babylon in its essence, when a man is worshipped and claims to be God. This is this man of whom we are reading tonight. So quickly, his advent, his appearance, his authority, his assassination, and look at his activity. 4 things are linked with it. A mouth speaking great things. That links you with Daniel chapter 8. That mouth, in eloquence and oratory, he's raising his fist against God. He's blaspheming God. He's saying there is no God. Evolutionary science has come to its full fruition. I hope not one here believes the lie of evolution. Scientists tonight are abandoning it in multitude. They find it inconceivable scientifically. Oh, man swallows it. Many still hold it because there's no alternative but God. They don't want God. They can't allow God. This man will stamp out God, as it were, and say, blasphemes God. Blasphemes the people in heaven. Those people that you think are in heaven, they're all lost. They're all gone. And his blasphemies find already here in the hearts of men. He has a mouth speaking great things. And then he's given a period, the second thing, 42 months. Remember, that's the last half of the week. And at the end of that time, his destiny is the lake of fire.
and is given to him to make war with the sin. This is the attack upon Israel, but it's much, much wider. It's all believers. And remember, there's a great number of believers. There's 144,000, but they were only the preachers. There's those that have professed through the preaching. And there are saints right across the world. You know, I believe that that great company of Revelation 7 is in fact the fullness of the Gentiles. The fullness of the Gentiles is not the church, but it's that great company. And I believe in this period, millions will be saved from the quarters of earth that have never heard the gospel. Millions from China and from areas that have never heard the message of the cross. Now, they respond to the preacher in that day. And this man will make war with them and try to wipe them out. And he'll do it almost. And overcome them. Don't you think that's a strange thing that God allows it? This will be the second company of the martyrs to join their compatriots of chapter 6. The second company, the company that die in the second half of the tribulation when this beast starts to make war with them. And then his power over every kindred and tongue and nation. You can't confine that to Europe, please. This must cover the globe. The man has a worldwide dominion. For the sake of those who would like to follow it up and who know their Bible, I suggest to you, this is the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. I suggest that this is the prince that shall come of Daniel chapter 9. I suggest that this is the man of sin of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And in one sense, please, he is an antichrist. John says many antichrists. But then he speaks of the antichrist. In some respects, you could put this man forward as a claimant. If you use the word anti against as meaning against, he's heading up the forces against Christ. But I'll give you another view in a moment. Please. Here is the beast from the sea. John watches and the dragon turns and there's another beast. But what a difference. This one comes up from the land. And you would hardly identify this as a wild beast. Look at the contrast. Look at his appearance. You'd hardly be a greater contrast. What do you see? You see a little lamb. A lamb. A young lamb. Two horns. All the appearance of a lamb. Ah, but just listen a moment. What's he saying? He speaks as a dragon. I have some difficulty in making up my mind whether that's the tones of the dragon. I'm not so sure. I think the emphasis rather falls upon what the dragon said. And if you listen to the sweet, dulcet tones of the smooth talker, you'd almost be deceived. But he is indeed speaking as the mouthpiece of Satan. And he's speaking as if he were the dragon. And that's going to be for the ill of man. Look at his appeal, please. We've looked at his appearance. And there are three words here that are differently translated in English, and rightly so, but they're all the same word in the Greek. And you have them, three verbs, exerciseth all the power of the first beast in his presence. That is, he is actually manifesting that same kind of power
And he's doing it in the very presence of the beast. Maybe they have a TV interview together. And he displays the mighty power. That's sea. And that power is the same power that brought the first beast into promise. And then he causes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast. Notice this. Whose deadly wound was he? You're seeing him pointing to the man and saying, look, didn't you see him die? Didn't you see him raised? You must worship him. That's the dragon toe. Because this man is identified later in the book of the Revelation as a false prophet. And he's filling that part in Israel. First man's a Gentile from the nation. This man is a Jew from the nation of Israel. And he is appearing to lead that nation into submission to the beast. You remember I spoke to you of the signing of the covenant. Very likely the point of the commencement of the 70th week, 7-year tribulation, is when this man signs the covenant with the man from the west. And from that point, it escalates as he leads his nation. You say, will Israel follow such a man? They rejected Christ when he came in his father's name. Here is one coming in his own day. And they will accept him. They will find in him the answer. They'll find in him the power that Christ refused to display. You remember they asked signs of the Savior. And he refused to accept the sign of the prophet Jonah, pointing onwards to his death and resurrection. But this man will do signs, and he doeth great signs. Wonders is the word in our authorized. What Christ refused to do, and he'll give the authentic sign of the prophet. He deceiveth, he'll give the authentic sign. What is that? It's Elijah's sign. The fire coming down from heaven. You remember Christ refused. But here he is, giving that authentic sign. Men say, Israel said, this is our man. This is our Messiah. And what I'm suggesting to you is that this is in fact the Antichrist. The one of whom John spoke, using ante in the correct sense of a replacement Christ. The substitute Christ. The one who takes the place of Christ. And I submit that this one has features of a king. He has features of a prophet. He has features of a priest. Pointing and saying, worship. Worship him. So he has features of prophet, priest, and king. The authentic Christ is a prophet, priest, and king. This false Christ, this replacement Christ, he is filling that vacancy in the nation of Israel and leading them to utter and complete destruction. That's the man that you have in the second beast. And the word is, he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the miracles that he doth. And then his aim, religiously, he says, look, that's such a great man there. Look at what he has done, what he's achieved. You must worship him. And I tell you what the best thing to do will be to make an image of him. And the image is made. And he does something dramatic. He giveth life, giveth breath, is the word to the image. and makes that image speak. Now you'll all agree that this could readily and easily be done today with present day technology. So I'm submitting to you this is something far beyond present day technology. Men will know this is supernatural. This is beyond the natural. We could do that. It can be done today, easily. But this is something beyond it. Something that men recognize there's a power behind this that we cannot deny. And he says, now, worship. Produces the image. And other scriptures will line up with this and tell us that this is the abomination of desolation. There was an abomination of desolation in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes away back in the history of Israel. And what did he do? He put an idol in the holy place in Jerusalem. An image to Jupiter, capital I. He said, that's your God. And the Maccabees died to resist. The Israeli nation died to resist the abomination of desolation. But this man will put another in. In that rebuilt temple. And he said, bow down and worship him. 2 Thessalonians 2 says, he himself will sit in the temple of God. Above all that is called God or that is worship. Claim to be God. Thus, for the allegiance of man, bow down to worship him. There's a religious thing. This is Babylonian religion unveiled in the last phase of the week. The last 3.5 years. But it goes beyond that. That image, I submit, will likely be the touchstone. And people will have to accept it. And I believe with increased technology, it will not only be in Jerusalem. There'll likely be an image in every main corporation in the world. Maybe even in the whole. Using TV and so on to bring people under control. Religiously. But allied with that, there will be the climax of things commercially. When he said, now, you've got to belong to the beast. And to belong to the beast, you need a mark. You need it on your hand or on your forehead. An identification mark that will indelibly and irrevocably link you with this man. What it will give you. Unimaginable privileges. And I tell you what, you'll be able to buy or sell. And if you don't have this mark, then you can't buy or sell. You'll be commercially and socially ostracized. This is when it will become a matter of life-threatening to give a cup of cold water in the name of Christ. You remember that? This is where it will actually become a matter of life or death for you even to shelter one that would claim to belong to Christ. So tight will be the control, likely in certain areas only, but the control demanded by these two men. What that mark is, we're told of a mark, we're told of a number. Now you can spend all night working out what that number is. That's 666. And it will be a great challenge to you to sit down and work it out. I'm not even going to make any suggestions.